Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, today. We've got a live show coming to you from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. And today we're going to be talking about a subject we have not really talked about in the year plus that we've been on the air with Media Matters, but it's an issue of considerable interest to me personally, your host, Bob McChesney, but also I think of considerable importance to the nation. And that is micro radio, low power FM radio broadcasting. And as I said at the outset of the show, one of the ironies of our time is that in an era in which we often talk about extraordinary revolutionary developments in communication technologies, so digital communication, that one of the most important and interesting revolutionary developments comes at the other end of the technological food chain, so to speak, with very inexpensive low-power radio broadcasting. And joining us to talk about this today, what's going on with this technology, and also the big political fight over it that's taking place as we speak in Washington, D.C., we have one of the real pioneers of low-power radio broadcasting, one of the real champions of it, Pete Tredish, joining us from Philadelphia. Pete Tredish is one of the founders of Radio Mutiny, 91.3 FM in Philadelphia, and its successor, RadioVolta.org. He is the founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, which is an organization that organizes low-power radio and provides free assistance for low-power FM radio applicants. He has been very active, if not the most active person, working in the campaign on behalf of creating and establishing legal low-power FM radio stations. It is my pleasure to welcome Pete Tredish to Media Matters today. Pete, are you there?
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. And I think that a lot of our listeners, unless you live in an area with a lot of low-power radio or you're involved in it, might not really be familiar with this technology and when it came along and what it does. Why don't you just give a little primer, if you will, about what low-power radio is. Is it a new thing? Has it just come along, or has it been around for a while? Or, what's the story there?
Well, there is low-power radio isn't really so different than any other radio station. It uses the same sorts of transmitters. It uses the same, really the same technologies that have been around for a long time. But and in fact, it used to be that small community organizations were able to get radio licenses to broadcast to their neighborhoods and their communities. Back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, there was what was known as a Class D radio license, and that was what most community groups applied for when they wanted to start a station for their neighborhood. A lot of high schools had these. A lot of college stations started out with these. They were for just 10 watts, and it was just pretty common that they would that there was neighborhood broadcasting. It was not so common that there was anything but sort of a freestanding radio station or a college, but that was what people used to use. In 1978, National Public Radio actually petitioned the FCC to stop granting these licenses because they had a number of kind of interesting plans where they wanted to build a national network, and they felt like a lot of these college stations and high school stations and others were in the way. And so the community radio license system was dismantled, and they didn't issue any more community radio licenses after 1980. And there was a sort of a bizarre bureaucratic situation where even for full-power non-commercial licensing, as of about 1980 to 1990, there was a lot of trouble in allocating the licenses. There was a very complicated system that no one could really quite figure out, and the FCC actually stopped allocating non-commercial licenses in about 92 or so, more or less. They put a freeze on anything with a computing application. There were just a few stations that got on in very, very rural areas. And ever since then, there really was no way for non-commercial licenses to go on the air.
Now, at the same time, if I understand it right, Pete Tredish, the capacity to do low-power broadcasting improved dramatically with changes in technology, which made it more accessible to people than it had been earlier by the 1990s. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. As all electronics became cheaper, it became really not all that difficult to build very small radio stations with cheaper and cheaper components and more ubiquitous components that are used in other things. And so what we found by the early 90s was that often you could build a transmitter from less than $100 worth of parts. And a number of kit manufacturers started manufacturing these kits for anywhere between $200 and $500 that, when linked to a bunch of consumer audio equipment, just a stereo or a CD player, like you have in your house, all of a sudden it could become a radio station.
You know, how powerful would a station like this be if you set one up in your home? Would it go off like a block or how far?
Well, that's kind of what we did. We set it up on the back porch of our house, and we actually reached the better part of Philadelphia. It went about 10 miles or so.
So that's pretty big reach. So Philadelphia's a few million people, isn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It was a 20-watt radio station, and people driving around could get it, 10, 12 miles away. I'd say people in their homes could get it, maybe 5 or 6 miles away, just because it's easier for cars to get radio stations further away because they're not indoors. So,
Peter, let me just back up 1 second and get to a point, because a lot of people listening already might be saying, why, if someone wants to do low power radio and they get one of these transmitters, why do they have to get government permission to do so? Why can't they just start broadcasting? I mean, why is the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, have anything to say about whether someone can broadcast or not?
Well, a lot of it goes back to early radio history, and in the very beginning, that's exactly what people did. Is many people just bought one of these apparatuses back then, and they just they would just turn it on, and maybe they were a doctor selling goat gland transfusions or whatever, or they were a labor union, or they were a corporation, and so many stations just did go on the air, and a lot of the earliest broadcast stations were unlicensed, and there was really no license allocation system. At a certain point in the late 20s, the companies started going to the Congress and going to the government and saying, "Wait a second, you have to make a roadmap here, because otherwise, it just becomes a situation where whoever has the most powerful transmitter wins." And
I mean, there's a limited number of slots that can be used, so it's not like if 10,000 people wanted to go broadcast in a community, they could all have a chance at it. There's only enough room for a smaller number than that.
Yeah, well, the way that the technology is set up. Now,
yeah.
I mean, some of the most cutting-edge things in technology really allow you to have a lot more channels than we used to.
But I'm talking about historically.
But historically, there was really, it was only set up that there were only so many frequencies that groups could use. And so the deal that was struck was that the broadcasters, whoever ended up getting these licenses, was supposed to really give back to the community. They were supposed to do what was known then as public service. They were expected to have their radio stations have like a certain, certain standards of fairness, certain sorts of, educational content, and in exchange, they got to operate the station and nobody else did. So it was kind of like a deal. The unfortunate part of that deal is that as the stations over the years became more sophisticated and started doing a lot of scientific research on the tastes and interests of their audiences, they discovered that the less educational and the less public service work that they did for the station, the more that they could maximize their profits. And so the broadcasters took it upon themselves to start suing the government to try to get rid of every sort of public service obligation that they had, making the sort of strange claim that as corporations, their free speech rights were getting limited.
So on one hand, if I can sort of sum it up, private interests were getting these monopoly licenses for scarce airwave channels from the government, and the government would protect their monopoly control, wouldn't let anyone use those channels. But on the other side, they said, we don't have any obligation then to the government for these monopoly licenses. Once we've got them, we can do whatever we want with them.
Exactly. And by the late 80s, the public service obligations had almost completely disappeared, and I would have a hard time naming even one or two.
I think the main ones actually have been the ownership restrictions, if that even qualifies as public service, but that's been the main form of regulations that have had any effect.
Yeah, I guess that there's still, you're still required to, be part of the emergency alert system so that, you know, there's, if a tornado is coming, the government can sort of take over your radio station and let people know. And there's a few other really kind of minor ones, but mostly that's all gone. And so it's kind of, people are kind of hard-pressed to figure out why these corporations at this point are still having these monopolies over these licenses, and they get the exclusive right to use them, but they don't really have any obligation to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the situation where
low-power FM radio comes in. Let me introduce our guest again. He is Pete Tredish, who's the founder of the Prometheus Radio Project. He's been one of the leading activists and pioneers of the low-power FM radio movement, which is right now in the midst of an enormous fight for its survival and growth in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to call in and ask Pete a question, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Pete, we're in the 1990s. We've got this new technology come along. It's not new, but it's sort of been accentuated with developments that makes it much more accessible. So you can do easy to set up a low-power FM station in your community if you want. You can start one up pretty easily. But you can't get a legal license to do it because the airwaves are pretty much locked up. But if I understand it, at the same time, there are open slots in the FM dial in almost every community in the country that are not being used. Is that right?
Well, yeah, really there are. It's kind of a strange thing. The FM dial was allocated back in 1948. When the FM service was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually before they even had quite invented the transistor. And there weren't a lot of steady-state electronics. And so they set the channels really, really wide for FM, 200 kilohertz. And so what they really discovered after not very many years was that actually there was room for quite a bit more between the allocated channels, and they started putting in a number of different services like the elevator Muzak channels, and they made FM into stereo, and they started putting other things into those channels. However, what the broadcasters really didn't want was they didn't want more radio stations that would be competing for listeners on the dial, and
the existing commercial broadcasters or non-commercial for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, both. And so what we had was this kind of strange situation of really false scarcity. And that was compounded by the fact that there were no licenses being given out for the 10-watt range, for the 100-watt range, for the 200-watt range. The smallest radio licenses you could really get were around 6,000 watts. And so there were a number of holes in the coverage that were actually perfectly usable by low-power stations that wouldn't cause any interference to the incumbents, but just weren't being given out because there wasn't a way to give them out. And that's sort of where the pirates came in.
Yeah, the pirate radio movement, and I think one of the pioneers of the pirate FM movement is not far from here over in Springfield, Illinois, with the start in the late 1980s. Talk a little bit about that pirate movement. So it comes along, the technology's there, there's openings in the FM dial, so people say, hey, let's get these kits, let's set up and start broadcasting to our community. Is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah, pretty much. The man you're mentioning is Mbana Kantako, and actually people sort of talk a lot about him, but they don't really talk about his family as much.
Mm-hmm.
He really started a kind of a family-run radio station in a housing project in Springfield, Illinois, and it's an incredible station. They just started broadcasting with 1 watt to their housing project, and it was a really kind of an amazing effort. And they operated for a number of years before they were even really noticed by the FCC or by the government. But when they actually were noticed was when they became really very effective at political organizing. There was a guy that lived in one of the projects that was beaten up by police, and Kantako went to the hospital and interviewed him. And the next day, there were, as a result of the interview on the radio station, there were protests at the police precinct. And within a week, the FCC had been called, and Kantako was informed that he was operating without a license. And what he did was something that no pirates had really ever done before. And before, there were plenty of pirates. There were plenty of sort of teenagers that were doing it in the garage. But the FCC agent would come, and they would say, look, kid, you know, you're real clever. You got a great future ahead of you in radio. Don't blow it now. If you turn that radio station back on, I'm gonna tell your mom, and that's gonna be it. But the difference was that while many pirate radio stations had been on the air before that were sort of a prank or were sort of a hobby of someone, Kentaco really sort of looked at the situation, and he had an analysis of it that it was exclusion based on race and class of the poor from broadcasting, and what we basically had was a wealth-based broadcasting system. And he also realized that the job of the FCC is not to decide the content of what goes on the air. And there's been, actually, the broadcasters have through a long string of litigation, have established that the government should not be deciding what kind of content goes on the air and what doesn't. The only thing the FCC is there for is to stop interference. And he said, well, look, I've been broadcasting for 3-4 years now, and no one's ever come here as a result of any interference complaint. What you're mad about is my content, because what I said on the radio caused a demonstration in front of the police station. Now, that's not the business of the FCC. And it was a kind of an interesting situation because it was very embarrassing to them. And he basically went there and he just said, he went to the federal building and he said, put the cuffs on me. I'd love to take this case to the courts. And the FCC really didn't want to get into it. And in fact, they just sort of decided they'd rather let this, let this lie. And so they just never came back. And to this day, he still operates. He's been busted once or twice. I think it's been 13 or 14 years now. But he's still on the air, and a lot of people started to notice that case and say, well, wait a second, this guy's been on the air for, 5 years, 7 years, 9 years now, and, no one's coming to get him. So in the wake of that very sort of courageous stand that he took, a lot of people, my group included, sort of jumped on the bandwagon and said, well, if he can do it, then let's see what happens to us. And, that was, in essence, what led to a movement of, perhaps as many as 1,000 pirates at some point.
We're talking to Pete Trudish today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in and talk to Pete, the number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now, Pete, while all this was going on with the rise of the low-power stations in the 1990s, in 1996, Congress passed the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which eliminated or greatly relaxed the ownership limits on radio stations in the United States, on the existing legal licensed radio stations. And what did that do to radio?
Well, it had a giant effect, which was that up until then, you were not able to own more than 40 total radio stations, 20 FM, 20 AM. Before that, it had actually been you could only own 7 radio stations, 7 FM, 7 AM. Now, for someone like me, I feel like I'm lucky, to be able to try to get to own one, So it didn't seem like that much of a, cramp in my business plan or anything like that. But apparently to some of these corporations, it seemed like a giant limitation of their free speech rights to own as much of the media as possible. So they went to Congress and they got them to take off just about all the limits on radio broadcasting. There was no limit to the number total that you could own. The number went up to you could own up to, I believe it's 35% of the radio stations in any given market. And there have been, sort of different formulas for that.
Loosely applied, I might add.
Yeah, so, in many towns, a corporation like Clear Channel, which owns 1,200 stations nationally, can own up to 8 channels. In some places, they even own more.
And when you had a situation like this where a very small number of companies dominated local and national radio markets, what did that tend to do to the local content of radio broadcasting?
Well, I'll tell you, it's best summed up in this call that I got when I was still operating a pirate station. It was the this guy that he called me up. He said, "Hey, are you the pirate?" And I was like, "Well, you know, who's asking?" He's like, "Well, I own 3 radio stations." And I was about to hang up on him. I thought he was going to report me or something. But he said, "No, wait a second, you know, hear me out. You know, I started in this business when I was 15. I worked my way up. You know, it was a station that was owned by some old guy. And I started out sweeping up. Then I learned to sell ads. Then I learned to go on air. Then I learned to do the engineering. By the time I was 30, the old man decided to retire, and he sold me his stations. And, you know, this guy told me, you know, I love radio. I've never done anything else. And I just want to stay in radio for the rest of my life, really, because I know how to make money, and I know how to run it." He had, like, a classic rock station, a Christian station, and I don't know, like maybe a news talk or something. But then he said, this was about 1998 or so, he said, "But I'm going to sell my stations next year. There's no way I can stay in this. You know, I've been proud to be a local business owner, and I've been proud to, like, work in this forever, but there's just no way for me to stay because my competition has fundamentally changed. You know, I pay for every hour of content that you listen to. I pay a local announcer to announce it, and I pay for, you know, and in exchange I get commercials that I sell. And, you know, been doing pretty well up till now. But now, for this guy, he said, now my competition is Disney. And Disney owns 100 radio stations across the country. They make their content once in a studio in Los Angeles somewhere. They pipe it up over the satellite, and they sell it in 100 markets. So they pay once, and they get 100 ad revenues. Plus, they get to make all these marketing deals. They get to, you know, cross-promote their theme parks. They get to use over the audio from their movies. They get to do all these sorts of things. Now, there's no way that I'm going to be able to survive in a world where it's me versus Disney. So he said, you know, "I'm just going out of business. I don't know what to do." And the reason I'm calling you, Mr. Pirate, is because I've been watching some of this pirate radio stuff, and I've been thinking about, you know, once I get out of the radio business, I'm thinking about becoming a pirate myself because there's no other way I'm going to be able to stay in radio.
You know, Pete, I've written about radio, as you know, for years, and if I had a dollar for every time I had a conversation, a letter, an email with the same content you just gave me or similar content, I'd have $10,000. I mean, it literally, hardly a week goes by I don't hear something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It was kind of that was a moment for me when I realized that I'd kind of stumbled on something that was, you know, was bigger than what I walked into it with, that it was really about sort of the Walmartization of American culture, and that that there were a lot of people that were going to be dislocated a lot as a result of the Telecom Act of 96, and that it was going to fundamentally change, you know, not only how we listen to radio, but really even it had a lot of potential to think to change the way that America thinks about itself.
We're talking to Pete Treatish today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got phone lines open, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're going to be talking in the second half of the show about the fight that's going on in Washington now to make low-power FM radio legal and to have ample number of these stations in our communities, not just a paltry number. And Pete Treatish is leading the struggle in that area. But let's go to our phone lines first. We've got a couple callers. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Pete Treatish. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
I'm sorry, I didn't know I was going to be first. I think I was told otherwise, so I'm away from my notes, too.
Well, we knew how especially important your call was going to be, so we bumped you ahead.
I wanted to, well, for one thing, I want you to send something to the show that's on right prior to you, since they gave this time to Samuelson, which is pertinent to what you're just talking about. He was talking about how wide our options are right now in Newsweek, apparently. And it was taken issue with a little bit by the host, but it's hard to believe that he can be asserting that at this point. But I wanted to ask about the 10-watt stations. Mm-hmm. Review that business. Community stations were kind of at a stasis for a while, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s, for a variety of reasons, maybe economic. But to speculate on whether if that 10-watt slot would have been kept available, you know, what could the media environment actually, how could it be looked different? I mean, it's always to say there is no alternative, but there are some alternatives, and the 10-watt slot was an important thing, and getting rid of that was... So I also wanted you to, if you could, talk about sort of the inspiration of the European pirates, because they did some amazing things in West Germany. They were broadcasting like 10-minute increments, you know, 10-minute segments to not be triangulated by the authorities. And they were breaking, obviously, the governmental control of licenses over there. And but it was quite inspiring to pirates here, I think. And obviously, it's kind of a another speculative question, but and I will be excited to hear what the prospects are in the second half hour for some actual moving on this. And I guess the convergence thing is true too. I listened to Radio Volta a little bit on the internet, so people can check it out there. So that is available. And I guess I'll thank you for your suggestion, and I'll keep tuned in. And, I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. Pete, before you give your answer or address the comments, could you give the email, excuse me, the website address for Prometheus for people who want to sort of get in touch with you or follow the work you're doing in this?
Yeah, sure. We are at www.prometheusradio.org, which is PROMETHEUSRADIO.ORG.
Okie dokie. Do you have some comments you'd like to make on the caller?
Well, yeah, sure. I think that, well, we'll get into this a little bit more in the second half an hour. I mean, actually, there is going to be a new 10-watt window where people are going to be able to apply for 10-watt licenses. And, you know, we're looking forward to that. We have no idea when it's really going to come out. In terms of speculating about what would have happened, it's actually a good question. I've never exactly thought about it. It was all sort of ancient history. I never was involved with radio before 1997, and so I really didn't understand or know very much about it at the time that they eliminated the Class D licenses. And by the time I had gotten involved, it had already been many, many years since most of that, you know, was long gone. So it's hard to say. I mean, I think that you can look at other countries and look at their broadcasting systems. I think certainly if you look at a place like Canada has retained a lot of classes of community licensing. And if you listen to their radio, it's just kind of incredible. It's very rich compared to the radio in the United States in a lot of ways. And certainly the public broadcasting sector is really a thriving one there. So,
you know, we've got a caller waiting, but before we get to that caller, let's dive right into what's going on with the politics in the last 5 years of LPFM, because I think to someone just listening to the show unfamiliar with it, they might think, well, this is sort of a technical thing for some sort of, you know, nerds or people who are into this sort of ham radio stuff, but it doesn't apply to me, and who cares about these stations? No one would listen to them. Instead, what we're talking about is, as you said, maybe 1,000 of these low-power stations blossomed all over the country during the 1990s. It became a real serious problem because these were unlicensed stations, technically illegal, although they, for the most part, to my knowledge, were never interfering with existing commercial and non-commercial stations in any substantial manner. But it became sort of like prohibition in the 1920s. I mean, they were illegal, and there was pressure on the government to stop it. But at the same time, there was such a critical mass, it was difficult to try to purge them. So what happened in the late 90s? And sort of give us a quick thumbnail of the political fight of the last 5 years.
Sure. Well, what happened was, eventually, when we got to having so many stations, that there came to be really, as you described, sort of a breaking point. Something had to happen one way or the other. And many of us were starting to understand more about communications politics. I mean, a lot of us started with just like a sort of a guttural response of like, you know, we know that this is a system that's unfair, that doesn't allow for community broadcasting, but we didn't know a lot about the, you know, we didn't know all the details of communications policy law or anything. But many of us were starting to cast it as an act of civil disobedience against the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And that started to really pick up some interest in Washington when people started understanding that we had not just like a criticism about why we couldn't start a community radio station in our neighborhood, but that we were looking at the entire system. And we really, through a variety of threats that, you know, maybe we could or couldn't do, I for one, you know, told the FCC that we were going to start 10 radio stations for everyone that they shut down. And you know, we started doing road trips and tours and showing people how to build pirate stations and promising them that we would make their life just completely miserable until they created a legal community broadcasting system. And really surprising no one more than me and no one more than the pirates, we started to get really a pretty sympathetic hearing at the FCC. At that time, the chairman was William Kennard, who had a long background. He started out by saying he was just going to go out and bust all the pirates. But once he actually started to hear what we were saying, he had a long history of civil rights communication law, and he looked at some of the effects of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, especially in minority ownership of media. And during that period, from 1996 to 1998 or so, minority ownership in media fell from the whopping 3% that it was down to something like 1.5% of radio stations.
Because basically minority station owners owned one or two stations at most, and all the small station owners are getting wiped out with when they raise the caps.
Absolutely. And so he started saying, well, wait a second, you know, I can't agree with what the pirates are doing, but I can kind of understand why they're doing it. And so he pledged that he was going to start a new community radio service. And at first we thought he was full of it. You know, we totally thought it was just a lot of PR. But as the rulemakings proceeded and we started filing things and so on, it just became more and more clear that it was going to happen. And ironically, the very week that my radio station, Radio Mutiny, was busted and they kicked down the door and they dragged out all the equipment and they cut it apart, he made a big announcement. He said he was opening the first rulemaking and that radio was well on its way to becoming a reality.
And this is back in 1999?
98.
And then it was finally a year or 2 years later that the FCC, after much study and evaluation, announced its program to create approximately 1,000 slots for low-power stations around the country. Is that right?
Yeah. In January of 2000, they approved the low-power radio service, and in April, they started taking applications.
And you know, we've only got about 15 or 20 minutes left. We could talk for days about this because it's so fascinating. This is really a revolutionary development. 1,000 new stations are all going to be nonprofit and non-commercial, locally based, run by nonprofit groups in communities, and every community probably get a couple of these, some communities more than two or three. Really, this is a seminal development in American media history, American political history. Everyone seemed to like the idea because, you know, who's not going to like the idea of having more local community voices in the radio, just additional voices? They don't detract from any of the existing voices, just more voices, and all people from the community and no advertising. Everyone really liked the idea except for one group of people in particular. Who was that?
Well, that was the incumbent broadcasters, the National Association of Broadcasters, and also at that time National Public Radio, came out and they said, you know, we really don't want the low-power radio service to go forward. And they tried, first of all, to just kill it outright.
This is by going to Congress. Once the FCC announced this plan, they went to Congress to have the Congress overturn it. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. They put together a bill called the Radio Broadcast Preservation Act of 2000. And at first, we didn't think that the bill had a chance of passing because it really just it sort of flew in the face of a lot of common sense. And it's very unusual for Congress to sort of micromanage the sort of technical and engineering decisions of the FCC. But it was slipped into an appropriations rider right during the election crisis of 2000 when not a lot of people were looking. And it took away about three-quarters of the radio stations that we had thought that we were going to get.
Now, the main argument, Pete, if I understand it, was that these new 1,000 stations that would be created, these low-power stations, would create interference for the existing stations. That was really the justification for lowering the number. Is that correct?
Yeah, they claimed that we would cause interference to the existing operations of the radio stations. And the thing about it is that there were about four studies of over about 80 receivers that were done in anticipation of the low-power service. And, of course, the studies that were done by the National Association of Broadcasters said that there was going to be interference. The studies that we did and the FCC did found that the level of interference was so negligible that it wasn't even really worth talking about. And so,
well, you know, Pete, I don't know if you know this, but I did an interview with Bill Kennard, the FCC chair who shepherded this program through, and what he told me was that the separation standards for the new LPFM stations they were going to do with the existing stations, they were using the same standards that the commercial broadcasters' engineers had approved 10 years earlier when they wanted to put a few more commercial stations in. So it was actually using the engineering reports that the NAB people had come up with a decade earlier.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. And, you know, without getting too much into the technical side of things, there's other services like the translator service, which is where you put a low-power station to repeat a full-power service station. And there are thousands and thousands of these all around the country. And essentially, they're the same as a low-power station. The only thing is they're not allowed to originate content. So you can't use them for a community broadcaster, but a full-power station can just go ahead and use one of those spaces to extend their signal coverage. So technically, it's kind of funny because the NAB and NPR tried to portray this as like this big mystery, like, oh gosh, no one really knows what happens when you put more radio stations on the dial. And that was so ridiculous. I mean, the FCC has been allocating radio licenses for over 50 years, and they know quite a bit about how much interference one causes. Well, so finally, what happened was Congress was so confused by all this, they just said, okay, the stations that are in very, very small towns and rural areas where they're pretty far from other signals, they can go on the air now. But the stations that are in bigger cities, we're going to make them wait until we get a study done of whether it's true what the National Association of Broadcasters and NPR are saying about this interference issue. And, the big news is that report, after 3 years, just came out about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and actually, surprising nobody, it found almost no interference coming from these low-power stations.
So if they had gone ahead with the Kennard plan of 2000, the SEC plan, and it had allowed 1,000 stations, there wouldn't have been any interference problems to speak of.
Yeah, it's become crystal clear because this report was done not by anyone even on either side of the issue. It was done by an independent agency. And they found, they looked around. They tested a number of receivers and a number of transmitter test sites, and they were never able to find a single case of significant degradation at a distance of more than about 330 meters from the transmitter site. So basically, what you're talking about is like there's going to be a radius of about a block or so around the low power site, where some people's clock radios might get a little bit of noise of some kind. Now, when you compare this to the full-power broadcasters, this is like just established practice in broadcasting that there's actually around a 50,000-watt station, there's a ring of about 4 or 5 kilometers that they cause, some kinds of interference to some of the cheapest sorts of radios. So what the broadcasters were really trying to do is they were trying to set a double standard. They were trying to say, well, interference is sort of limited round the transmitter site effects are just part of doing business for us. But if there's any kind of effect from that, from like even a tiny community radio station, that's too much. That's too much interference to add to the dial.
We're talking to Pete Treatish today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the low-power FM radio movement, and as he just chronicled, we had a major study just released a few weeks ago, which basically said that the plan to create 1,000 new low-power FM stations in this country was technologically legitimate, that the claims of the commercial broadcasters and NPR, I might add, to stop this 3 years ago were not founded on science. We will take calls still for people who want to call in. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have someone we want to go to right now. Line 2, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Pete Treatish.
Hello. I actually have 2 questions. One is maybe you could address the, say if you actually wanted to go through the actual licensing process legitimately. I know it's prohibitive, basically, because of filing fees, et cetera. and wait time, but maybe detail a little bit of, like, why the legitimate process to start up a radio station is so difficult. And for number two, maybe something about the idea of, similar to cable access television, having certain frequencies reserved in a spectrum for communities to have access to that, the community members would. That's
yeah,
it.
Sure.
Thanks.
With the licensing process, it is very difficult. There actually are no fees. It's totally free to apply for a low power station, which is kind of exciting. And I know that actually in Urbana, there are some applications in that are currently pending. But the big problem is the wait. And this is one of the things that we were most upset about when the rules came out, is there's no schedule. So the FCC basically, when they feel it's politically expedient or when they feel like it, they open up a window and they allow people to apply for 5 days. And then if you don't make it into that, you just have to wait. And you could wait 2 years, you could wait 5 years, you could wait 10 years. There's just no schedule for when they're going to open and close these windows. And so that really makes it difficult for community groups to get involved in this.
Yeah, Pete, can I just interject and follow up on that one point? I mean, the current FCC, as we've talked about on this show, and I know you know, has been mired in a big controversy concerning its relaxation of the broad media ownership rules in the U.S. this year. Now it's being fought over in Congress. And it underwent a lot of accusations and charges that it was, in fact, basically serving the interests of the big media owners and not concerned with the affairs of the general public as it relaxed these media ownership rules. What's your sense of the FCC, or at least the majority of the five members? Are they sympathetic to LPFM? Do you have any sense that this is an issue they care about, or is it an issue that they're not really that plugged into?
Well, I'd have to say that the FCC at this point, when the administration changed hands in 2000, they have become much less sympathetic to low power FM. Now, they haven't said anything against it, and they've been giving out the licenses, and that's all true, but it really has been dragging very, very slowly. There were about 3,200 applications in 2000, 2001, and today fewer than half have been resolved one way or another. And so there are lots of these community groups out there that have been waiting for 3 years now and have never even gotten so much as a postcard from the FCC. And, when you contrast that to the sorts of things that Michael Powell says about corporate media mergers, he says, I want, if a merger comes on our table, I want it to be processed in 21 business days or something like that. It's definitely like there's an ethic of service to the corporations, but when it comes to the community groups, it's sort of like, on the one hand, it's a sort of a hurry up and wait attitude, and on the other hand, it's a kind of a whenever we get around to it. And I don't think that's true at the staff level. I think the staff have been really supportive of low power radio, but in terms of the overall priorities of the agency and where they assign staff and where they put their money and their resources, it's at this point, it's much more towards pushing through these changes that the corporations really want.
Is this a issue that divides along party lines, Republican, Democrat, or along ideological lines, liberal, conservative, from your experience?
Well, it's funny, because in the political arena, often it does divide along party lines or along ideological lines. But in terms of who's building these radio stations, not really. There's one station that I've been working with a little bit. It's in Edinburgh, Maryland, and it's the licensee is a local school. They have a bunch of hours of programming that's targeted towards 3 to 5 year olds in the mornings, and in the afternoons they have Ollie North on. That's their one syndicated show that they take is the Ollie North Hour. And so there's a number of small conservative stations and a number of church groups that run stations, but unfortunately, the sort of the social conservatives that tend to be running these stations, their conservative congressmen are not really serving their interests. They're serving the corporate conservative agenda by basically protecting the existing broadcasters. And really, we've tried quite a bit to try to make coalitions and to get some of these conservative members of Congress mobilized. But, you know, really, when it comes down to it, they're not really serving that master. They're serving the corporations. And the one exception is John McCain. John McCain has been, there's, you know, a lot of things I don't agree with John McCain about politically, but on Low Power FM, he's been a fantastic ally.
And he is the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, the relevant committee that regulates the SEC, so he is a very good ally to have.
Yeah, he has really taken the broadcasters on this issue, and he's really sort of laid it all out.
So what do you think what do you think the chances are that in the coming months, now that this report has come out to expose that the campaign against LPFM was based on bogus science, what do you think the chances are that John McCain and members of Congress can then say, okay, let's go back to the original plan since it was a valid plan and create this new tier of nonprofit, low-power community stations?
Well, that's just really, it comes down to a question of political will and what Prometheus and other groups are going to be doing over the course of the next couple months is trying to get some of these new stations that are on the air, get them into their congressman's office, and get them to explain just what this is doing for their communities. We're going to try to get them in across the political spectrum, and we're really going to hope that people realize that community radio can be a really important part of just like basic local democracy. And from our point of view, it's really a community radio station is a place where everybody in a community can really come together, and you can see all kinds of different viewpoints and all kinds of different cultures. And when it comes down to it, a town that doesn't have a community radio station, to us, it's like a town that doesn't have a public library or doesn't have a public school system. It's just one of those public facilities that every place should have. And it should just be a centerpiece of the local democratic system that we have.
But Pete, what do you say to folks who go, come on, Pete Treatis, you're talking 19th century, early 20th century stuff. We're living in the 21st century with the Internet. Anyone can start a website. Why should these people care about what the government says with radio? You can just go online and do a community website.
Well, it's the Internet is a very, you know, it's a very dramatic development for all of us, obviously. And I think that the one thing that you really risk when you put all your eggs in the Internet basket is, well, first of all, there are a lot of Americans that are still not connected. And the Americans that are not connected to the Internet tend to be the poor. And so when someone like Chairman Powell says that it's okay to have a consolidated old media to allow the newspapers to buy the television stations and television stations to buy the radio stations and the radio stations to buy the cable companies, when you have that going on, what you end up is having media diversity for the rich, but an incredibly a media that's more consolidated than ever for the poor. And so you have very, very few corporate owners determining most of what, you know, a large percentage of Americans see. And, you know, I mean, I look around my neighborhood. I mean, my neighborhood, I probably am one of two or three houses on my block, that on my entire block, that actually has Internet access. And that continues to be the case, and it's going to continue to be the case for a number of years because of the political economy of Internet access. But even on a deeper level than that, you know, beyond the access issue, I think that it's important that to realize that what the corporations are doing right now is they are using their consolidated control over the old media to establish a place and establish market dominance in the new media. And so you see a company like Clear Channel, you know, they don't just own radio stations, they own billboards, and so they use the billboards to promote their radio stations. They use their radio stations to promote their concert venues. You know, they use their concert venues to promote ticket sales and, you know, and all this sort of thing. And they're going into even new things. So really, in this day and age, you can't just have a website. You know, you can't just have one sort of media. What you really need is a system of media and promotion. And so to leave radio out of the equation, well, I mean, I'll tell you what, you know, some of these corporations, they could have the internet if they'd give us all the radio licenses back.
And, yeah, it's interesting.
I doubt they would do it.
It's interesting because, yeah, the same companies that say, well, gee, it doesn't really matter if we have all the radio stations or TV stations because people can go on the internet, they don't want to give up their licenses. They seem to understand they still have significant market and political impact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they own Spectrum is what it comes down to. I mean, they're licensees of Spectrum, and they are still using it. They're still making money on it. People are still listening. And so I think it's important to not be confused by people sort of playing a shell game like, oh, you can have this, so you can't have that. Really, we live in a democratic society. All of our media should be democratic.
You know, Pete Tredish, our guest today, one of the founders of the Prometheus Radio Project, which works on creating low-power FM radio stations and is a part of the movement now to have the government make legal the plan put forth by the FCC 3 years ago to create over 1,000 local community radio stations that would go in addition to the existing commercial and non-commercial stations in every community. Pete, what can people do? We just have a minute or so left. What can folks do if they want to learn more, they want to get involved, they want to register their voice here to create this new tier of non-commercial stations in our country?
Well, one great way to start is first of all, to contact us and see if there are any low-power stations already in your community. And community stations are a great project to get involved in. So start out by supporting them and, you know, get involved. You know, start doing a show, you know, whatever your interest is, the music of Lower Serbia or, you know, the local public affairs or anything. And then, you know, I would say, you know, if there isn't a station around you, you know, think about starting one because it may not be so impossible, you know, in a year or two from now. And the other thing I'd say is, you know, it's really time for Congress to know about these stations. And I think that it's important to tell them that you want these stations to go forward and that you want them to succeed. And really, it's only Congress that's holding them back at this point.
And the web address for those who want to get in touch with Pete Tredish at the Prometheus Radio Project is www.prometheusradio.org. Is that right?
That's true. And it will not be too long before you might see another online petition campaign similar to some of the campaigns that helped to affect the battle over media ownership in Congress.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Pete Tredish. It's been a pleasure having you. A very informative hour for our guest here on Media Matters. And we'll be in touch in the future, I'm sure. And to our listeners, I want to let you know that next week we're going to have a pre-recorded show with Carrie Nelson talking about the state of academic freedom and commercialization of higher education. In coming weeks, we've got Francis Boyle, John Wilson, Jim Boughton, and Noam Chomsky. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be back in a couple weeks. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, our producer, and see